Joining us now, first time on the show, but glad we could get him on. Former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama, Jay Towne joins us. Jay, how are you this morning?
Doing great. It's icy and snowy up here in Huntsville, but we already got to go outside with my daughter, and we already played in the snow. It's been a long morning already. But glad to be on with you. Nice and warm here in my home office.
Well, at least we got power. We could be thankful for that. A lot of places just kind of having to weather the winter wonderland without the option of heat. But it could be a lot worse.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, let's get right into it. First off, I think you come at this from an interesting perspective, working at the Department of Justice, knowing the federal courts and the way the protocol there, but the impeachment trial, although it is federal mm-hmm. in nature, this was hardly anything that resembled what you might see in a court of law.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's very convenient when the House managers would talk about the prosecution or the jury being the Senate, or the charging document being the article of impeachment. They made it seem to be like a trial, because a trial carries with it the seriousness of due process. And in this country, that is a norm that we all take very seriously. But then when you peel back what actually happened, for instance, the article of impeachment itself was a hastily and poorly crafted document. If you really were serious about impeaching in convicting Donald Trump, then you would have taken your time. And if you really believe that you can impeach a former president, so there's no need to start any of this before January 20th at noon when he is asked to leave. So you could have did like they did, at least in the first impeachment, had hundreds of hours of hearings in various committees. You have constitutional experts come in and talk about the constitutionality of impeaching a former person of high office, like a president. You get interviews, so you know what Kevin McCarthy's conversation with the president was, right? You're not guessing. You know what various people that you want to interview, like, for instance, the sergeants at arms for the Senate and the House. I would like to know why they didn't call in the National Guard and waved off on extra bodies at the Capitol on January 6th. I think those are reasonable witnesses to have. If you really wanted to convict President Trump and get him to never hold office again, you would have done all of those things. They didn't do any of it. And even on the very last day, Jeff, you saw them considering calling more witnesses. Now, I've tried more cases than any lawyer that was in that chamber that day. I've prosecuted well over 10,000 people in my career. And I can tell you this, when you're getting ready to close to a jury, in this case, the Senate, you don't say to yourself, you know what? I probably need to call some more witnesses. And if you do say that to yourself, that means that your case is weak. And then when you don't call any witnesses and after you showcase that you might need them, it makes your case look even weaker. So I just, there was nothing about this. I mean, the victory lap that Raskin and others took about getting 57 votes, after it was all over, was the most in history. Okay, you lost. It's like Notre Dame saying, hey, in the college football playoff this year, I'm a Notre Dame graduate, Jeff. Our game against Alabama was the closest of the three games, the two semifinal games and then the championship game. So clearly we were the second best team. I mean, what does that get you? That and a dollar won't even buy you a Diet Coke anymore. So I don't know what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, let me ask you this. Raskin, Swalwell, the House managers, the defense lawyer Van Der Veen for Donald Trump points this out about there was an altered tweet, whatever. They made a kind of a video, a flashy video that was more made for TV than I think for that chamber. But they had to, like, recreate it or whatever. But it looked like, it was the date was changed and it was validated. In any other court of law, that would be considered altering evidence, doctoring evidence, if you're presenting it as evidence. Is there any, because this was political in nature, not in a courtroom, is there any action that could be taken against, any counsel that would use evidence or doctor evidence in such a way?
Well, the House does have its own ethics rules, and I'm not an expert on those ethics rules, but my guess is there is something about candor. And being candid when you are a House manager or speaking on the floor of the Congress. And so if there was an intent to mislead, then that is certainly something that at least a Republican could refer to the ethics office. But you mentioned the evidence here. Let me just say, if this were a trial, it is very hard for me, other than the tweets by Donald Trump, right? I'm not sure there was any admissible evidence. If somebody wanted to come in and talk about their conversation with Donald Trump, that would be direct evidence, and that would be something that would be admissible. But somebody coming in and talking about a conversation they had with someone who had a conversation with President Trump, that's inadmissible. That's all hearsay. And these videos, and, that's fine. They proved it was a bad day. They proved it was awful. And it was awful. And there was nothing patriotic about what happened on January 6th. They just never proved it was Trump's fault. And they spent all this time on dereliction of duty and what he didn't do to stop it once the breach began. I dare anyone. I have the article of impeachment in front of me right now. You find where dereliction of duty or his failure to do something after the breach began is anywhere located in this very poorly crafted document. You find it, and I'll admit that I was wrong. Otherwise, this just points to how hasty Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House, they were so eager to get to this point, but it was a political point that they were trying to make. They didn't want to really impeach Trump. They wanted to get senators on the record for voting no.
Yeah,
Republicans. Yeah,
I think you're spot on with that analysis. That this wasn't ever meant to be serious, but we were forced to treat it like it was a serious act. I wonder if you did the same thing in a courtroom, a federal courtroom, with the indiscretions they took, not just a breach of protocol, but actually changing something or making something up that never existed. The courts would come down hard on you, wouldn't they?
Yeah, there would have been consequences. I wasn't asked, I did have some friends still in high levels of government when this was at least it showed to be coming. And it was my thought that the best defense, I thought that the president could have his legal team file, their briefs about the extra-constitutional nature of an impeachment of a president that is no longer president, right? He's a citizen. File those briefs, have them be pithy and as well cited as they could be, and then don't even show for the rest of the trial. If they get past that, which you knew they were going to, have Eric Swalwell argue to an empty desk. There could have been no greater juxtaposition of this empty suit and Eric Swalwell talking to an empty counsel's table, right? It would have been fantastic. And honestly, you wouldn't have had, I don't know that Trump's team was that impressive either, right? And I thought Congressman Raskin did a fantastic job. But after you lose, I don't think you go around and take a victory lap on the Sunday morning talk shows either. I mean, if your goal was to impeach, if your goal was to get 57 votes, which was to lose, then I'm not sure why you were the House manager. I thought it was a very impressive, unnecessary event. And President Biden actually could have said, just call the whole thing off, guys. We're going to move on to my agenda. And he would have looked magnanimous in doing so.
Joined by former U.S. Attorney Jay Towne here on the program. Jay, I guess the something I think you could really speak to here, and we've spent a lot of time on it on this radio show, Alabama's prison situation, the Eighth Amendment, violations or the allegations of such, and what's being done to fix those. You were involved while you were at the Department of Justice in that. From your perspective and being on the other side of this, so you hear from these lawmakers and these officials, state officials all the time, where do you see the state at right now?
Yeah, I mean, so as the United States Attorney for the Northern District, my office, which is out of Birmingham, my office led the investigation for the Department of Justice into this matter. I signed the investigations that we dropped on the state. My office was I had a full time staff working on this around the clock for several years with Civil Rights Division up at DOJ. And, this is not, for anybody that wants to put this problem on anybody who's an elected official right now, I just don't see it. This is a 20 or 30 year old problem. And this is when we see this around the country, when prisons and jails are dilapidated, it's because states or county commissions don't want to invest any money in their detention centers. And pretty soon they get so bad that they actually violate the Constitution because the safety of those facilities are so poor. The conditions are so poor. And that's where we are with many of the male prisons in the state of Alabama. And so that's where we are. Now, the state legislature, they did appropriate, I want to say like $42 million. That number could be off, but several, tens of millions of dollars for Alabama Department of Corrections to get more staff. Governor Ivey's taken the step of getting what will amount to be, I believe, three new prisons, super prisons, which will allow you to close some of the prisons that exist right now that need more work than it's worth, right? I mean, they're not fixer-uppers. They're tear-down and rebuilds. So when you do that and you ship that prison population over to these other new facilities, then, you have safer facilities that are cleaner, more sanitary. You can protect the prisoners themselves easier. And you also have space for programming, for reentry and things like that, which is incredibly important to get prisoners. When they leave, they don't go back to a life of crime and recidivate. They become taxpayers and productive citizens. And that doesn't happen very often. But the more we can get prisoners to do that, the better off the state's going to be. So, and I will say this too, I'm unaware of any legislation that was put forward at any time in the last couple of years when we've been talking about this. And this litigation really goes back a couple of years before April 2nd of 2019, when we dropped the investigation on the state. And I don't remember any legislation where, hey, here's like for a bond issue, for instance, or it's a little too late now. The DOJ Civil Rights Division is pretty much undefeated in these types of matters. So it's just a matter of mitigating it at this point, if you're the state of Alabama, to a point where it's as painless as possible.
Yeah, Colts, watching how this unfolded, and we I assume you, like a lot of us in the media, were watching this. We're going to address this in a special session any day now. Well, we got to wait for the Sentencing Commission to get some recommendations on sentencing guidelines. There was always an excuse or a reason for, maybe excuse is a little harsh of a criticism, but there's always a reason for delaying action until this happens or this happens. And then finally COVID gets here. And, well, we can't do anything because of COVID. And it just looked like the clock ran out and without anything ever really happening substantively.
Yeah, well, and that probably has some truth to it. I mean, I COVID made it less, it wasn't as easy to enter in negotiations and things like that to try to work things and inspect things. But it's like going to, imagine if you walked into like a hoarder's garage, right? There's not a reasonable place to start cleaning that out. You just have to pick a corner and go. And that's kind of where we are with our prison system here in the state of Alabama. There's they're, I mean, you can't just start letting people out. I mean, you can. I advise against that. I've put a lot of, I spent a lot of time putting those people in prison when I was in the DA's office in Madison County. You know, if you're in prison in Alabama, it's really hard to send somebody to prison. It's really hard in Alabama. You got to have, if it's a nonviolent crime, 6 or 7 prior felonies, or you're on probation at the time, or you've done something violent, right? I mean, it's really hard to go to prison in the state of Alabama. And so if you're there, you've done, you've got a little body of work. And so we can't just let people out. But we can't have people in prison that are unsafe either, you know. And so those are, you know, a really difficult issue. And it, the solution really is going to be money. It's going to be more guards and better facilities in making these male prisons safe. I get why people don't want to spend money on prisons because it's they'd rather spend that money on new schools. Totally reasonable argument. But I also believe that people believe in the Constitution, and if they understood the Eighth Amendment, which is sort of an obscure amendment when it comes to punishment, crime and punishment, if they understood it, I think they'd agree that we can do better in the state.
Jay, we're up against a break here out of time, but thanks for making time for us. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good, Jeff. Thanks. Have a great day.
You do the same. That was former U.S. Attorney Jay Towne on the line.